Well, we've all heard the saying, you are what you eat. That has to be nuanced. I eat a lot of eggs. Not really, you know, made of eggs. What it means, though, is that what you eat largely determines sort of like your health, right? If you eat in an unhealthy manner, you're probably going to be an unhealthy person. What you consume affects your body to a great degree. Research in recent years bears this out. It shows a tremendous connection between our diets and our physical health. But even more, it shows a connection between our diets and our mental health. You are, in a real sense, what you eat. Jesus actually said something that's related to this, though on a surface level reading it may not appear to be related. In his Sermon on the Mount, he instructed his disciples to not store up treasure on earth. He said instead to lay up treasure in heaven, because treasure in heaven is incorruptible. It cannot be lost. It cannot rust. It cannot be eaten by bugs. It cannot be stolen. But then he said this, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Okay. If you want to know where a person's heart is, where his or her true affections lie, then see where that person's treasure is. See what he spends his time pursuing. See how she spends her money. See what they do with their resources. I mean, look, a person whose life is filled with drama is a person who invests in drama. A person whose life is filled with anger and resentment is a person who invests in anger and resentment. Whatever you feed your mind with, remember, you are what you eat. Where your treasure is, Jesus said, your heart will be also. Now, if you constantly tell yourselves all the things you do not have that other people have, you will become envy. If you constantly remind yourself of the ways others have wronged you or have disrespected you or have just dismissed you, you will become anger. If you constantly worry about your physical appearance and whether others find you attractive, you will become vanity. And if you constantly fret about the future, whether concern over your physical health or your financial health or whether your company will downsize your position or whether you will get married or whether you will stay married, you will become fear. If, however, you will invest in seeing this world from God's perspective, and if you will remind yourself of God's goodness and his kindness, and if you will live a life of repentance and faith, and if you will seek first his kingdom, you will discover that despair has no place in your life. You will discover that fear cannot find a foothold in your life. You will discover that frustration and failure and an overwhelming sense of your own inadequacy simply cannot define you, because you will find your treasure to be in the truth of God in Christ, driven deep into your heart by God's Spirit. This is where we find victory. We are in Judges 9 today. I'm going to finish the chapter. Whomever the author is, wrote the following words. Verse 22, Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years, and God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem, and the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood be laid on Abimelech their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. And the leaders of Shechem put men in ambush against him on the mountaintops, and they robbed all who passed by them along that way. And it was told to Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, moved into Shechem with his relatives, and the leaders of Shechem put confidence in him. And they went out into the field and gathered the grapes from their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and reviled Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech? And who are we of Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? Would that this people were under my hand. Then I would remove Abimelech. I would say to Abimelech, increase your army and come out." Then Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed. His anger was kindled. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and they are stirring up the city against you. Now, therefore, go by night, you and the people who are with you, and set an ambush in the field. Then in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as your hand finds to do. So Abimelech and all the men who were with him rose by night and set an ambush against Shechem in four companies. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance of the gate of the city. And Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from the ambush. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the mountaintops." And Zebul said to him, "You mistake the shadow of the mountains for men." Gaal spoke again and said, "Look, people are coming down from the center of the land, and one company is coming from the direction of the diviner's oak." Then Zebul said to him, "Where is your mouth now, you who said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Are not these the people whom you despised? Go out now and fight with them." And Gaal went out at the head of the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him. And many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. And Abimelech lived at Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not dwell at Shechem. On the following day, the people went out into the field, and Abimelech was told. He took his people and divided them into three companies and set an ambush in the fields. And he looked and saw the people coming out of the city, so he rose against them and killed them. Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city, while the two companies rushed upon all who were in the field and killed them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He captured the city and killed the people who were in it, and he razed the city and sowed it with salt. When all the leaders of the tower of Shechem heard it, they entered the stronghold of the house of El-Berith. Abimelech was told that all the leaders of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. And Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bundle of brushwood and took it up and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to the men who were with him, "What you have seen me do, hurry and do as I have done." So every one of the people cut down his bundle and, following Abimelech, put it against the stronghold, and they set the stronghold on fire over them, so that all the people of the tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. Then Abimelech went to Thebes and encamped against Thebes and captured it. But there was a strong tower within the city, and all the men and women and all the leaders of the city fled to it and shut themselves in, and they went up to the roof of the tower. And Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and drew near to the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest they say of me, 'A woman killed him.'" And his young man thrust him through, and he died. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, everyone departed to his home. Thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. It's a bright, cheery text for us. You know, when we read Scripture as a whole, and especially the narrative sections of it, it's really easy for us to miss the lived experience of those who were there. For example, our text begins with the words, "Abimelech ruled over Israel for 3 years." It doesn't really describe what life under Abimelech was like during those 3 years. But also remember that when it says over Israel, it doesn't mean over all 12 tribes, right? It means what it means when the book says that a judge ruled over Israel for a time. It means he was in charge of Israelites, but not all Israelites. The judges were rulers over certain areas or small regions of the nation. Now, the men of Shechem had made Abimelech king. He's king over that small area within Israel, and he ruled for 3 years. Now, here's where we miss the lived experience of the people. The text doesn't say much about those 3 years, but do you remember how Abimelech came to be king? Remember, he had received money from the temple of Baal-berith, or also called El-berith in our text. And he used that money, by the way, remember, it was a small amount of money, but he used that money, the text tells us, to hire worthless and reckless fellows to follow him. So together, he, with this small army, went to his father's estate and brutally executed his brothers, murdering them one after another. When a man comes to power in such a brutal and bloodthirsty manner, he does not suddenly become a wise and benevolent and beneficent ruler. Instead, he simply is a brutal and bloodthirsty ruler. This is characteristic of these 3 years of Abimelech. Now, he ruled over Shechem and over Shechem's surrounding villages in this way. It's interesting that the text does not say God raised up an oppressor over them. We've seen this cycle already. Israel whored after the gods of Baal. They followed after Baal-berith. They made Baal-berith their god at the end of the Gideon story. But the text does not say that God raised up an oppressor to discipline his people. In this case, the Lord didn't have to raise up a person to discipline his people because his own people chose one of their own to do it for him. Literally, one of their own. That's why the people of Shechem made Abimelech king. And then we see Abimelech oppresses them for 3 years with more of the violence and more of the chaotic fear that characterized his life. But it's also interesting. It doesn't say God raised up Abimelech, but it also doesn't say that God raised up a deliverer. Instead, God himself is going to intervene. God himself is going to deal with this problem that is Abimelech. And so in verse 23, we read that God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. Now, this does not mean God sent a demon. I mean, from our cognitive environment as 21st century Americans, that's what we hear. It means something quite different. The truth is Christians, for literally millennia, have wrestled with the very notion of evil, right? The question is often asked, if God created everything, then did God create evil? It does not mean that. It's because evil is not actually a thing. Evil is the absence of a thing. See, evil is like cold. There's no such thing as cold. Cold is simply what we call the absence of heat, right? Your car's air conditioner is not producing this thing called cold. Instead, it is taking heat from inside the car and transferring it outside the car. It doesn't create cold. It removes heat. Now, it's clunky for us to say, there's a tremendous absence of heat in the atmosphere today. So what do we say? It's really cold outside. It's just how we describe the absence of heat. Evil is the absence of good. When God created, remember, he declared his creation was very good. It had the positive attribute of being very good. But then when Adam sinned against God, Adam's actions lacked the positive quality of good. The absence of good is what we call evil. Really, two kinds of evil. There's, of course, moral evil. When someone harms another person, the harm lacks good, and so that is an evil action against another human being. That's a moral evil because humans are morally culpable for their behavior. But there's also natural evil, right? We've seen on the news, when wildfires destroy homes and businesses and take human life, there's a lack of good in the fire. Fire can have good purposes. What would a steak be without fire? But when fire lacks good, that is a natural evil. Fire's not morally culpable, yet it does not contain the positive quality of good. So this evil spirit God sends between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem is merely God allowing the spirit between them, the relationship they had, to deteriorate to the point where it lacks any good. It is an evil spirit between them. Verse 23 says, the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. Apparently, they very quickly began to regret making him king. But God is working behind the scenes in this. Remember, we've seen God is always doing 10,000 things, and sometimes he lets us see some of them. His purpose in allowing this relationship between them to deteriorate is actually stated in verse 24. He says it's so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come and their blood be laid upon Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. Listen, this isn't karma. This is God's justice. Sin always produces death. It may be pleasurable for a time, but the inevitable outcome of sin is always death. The sin of Abimelech, the sin of the men of Shechem, who empowered the evil and brutality of Abimelech, is producing death. And what is death? It is the absence of life. We see this absence of life in verse 25, right? These men who chose Abimelech to be their king put men in ambush for him. right? They're hiding out on the mountaintops, hoping that he passes by, that they might attack him and kill him if he happens to approach the city. But notice near the end of verse 25, their evil only produced more evil. It says that they robbed all who passed by that way. Innocent, ordinary people who had nothing to do with Abimelech were being robbed, brutally attacked by these men. You see, the oppression of God's people here is not coming from a foreign enemy. It's coming from within. The men of Shechem were largely non-Israelites, but they had over the years assimilated into the people of Israel. And as we've seen, that the conquest of Canaan wasn't about eliminating certain people groups. It wasn't about genocide. Instead, it was about purging the land of idolatry. Israel not only refuses to purge the land of Canaanite idolatry, Israel is refusing to purge idolatry from their own lives. And for this reason, the oppression comes from within. But try to imagine the chaos of those 3 years, right? The people know that there are roads they cannot travel at night, right? We all get that idea. But they also know that there are roads that they can't travel during the day, because if you travel these roads, you might get robbed, you might get beaten up, you might be worried, they might kill you for it. There are sections of the land that you don't go to because of the danger. I mean, what do you do if the wrong part of town is your whole town? The entire city of Shechem is the wrong place to be. See, this is the chaos of life under Abimelech, Israel's self-chosen ruler. This is the chaos of sin. It is the absence of good in every area of life, and it brings suffering to God's people. But then in verse 26, a man named Gaal moves into Shechem with his extended family. Now, given his deep knowledge of the history of Shechem and how quickly the leaders of Shechem warm up to him and trust him, it seems as though he's probably, almost certainly, originally from Shechem. Perhaps he left when they made Abimelech king. There may have already been some bad blood between them. He probably knew how that was going to turn out. Maybe he's aware that there's hostility between Abimelech and the leaders, and so he's trying to come back in to be in at just the right time. But when he comes back, the text says it was time for harvest. Yeah, I felt that one. So it's a grape harvest. They bring their grapes in, they stomp on them to make juice. That juice is eventually going to be put into bags to make wine. So as part of this celebration, they're having a massive party. It says that they're celebrating. They go into the temple, because the temple of El Berith, right there in the city, is where you'll go for these things. So they're eating, they're drinking, and no doubt, they're getting drunk. We know it's very obvious that Gaal seems to have been quite drunk. That's why in verse 28, he loudly boasts against Abimelech, asking why we who are of Shechem, notice how he includes himself in their number, why they together should serve a guy like Abimelech. In verse 29, he not so subtly suggests what he would do if he were king. He would challenge Abimelech directly. In fact, he would taunt him, increase your army, make it bigger, and then we can talk about a fight. See, he seems to know Abimelech's army is a bunch of worthless and reckless fellows. Now, what do you get when you have an army of worthless and reckless fellows and you add more worthless and reckless fellows to it? You get a bigger army of worthless and reckless fellows, right? This is not an army you want to go to war with. In his drunken state, Gaal is pretty confident how such a fight would turn out. But there's a couple other things we need to notice in his words. Yes, the degree of boasting is higher because of the wine, but there's something more being said, right? It's, in wine there is truth, as the old Latin expression says. He says in verse 28, "Is he, Abimelech, not the son of Jerubbaal?" I remember his name was actually Gideon. The people nicknamed him Jerubbaal because he tore down his father's altar to Baal, depriving them of their community worship site. Now, the nickname Jerubbaal means "let Baal fight him." By connecting Abimelech to the one who fought Baal, he's diminishing him in their eyes even further. Remember, they made Baal Berith, a variation of Baal, their god. So Abimelech is the son of the one who's been causing all of their problems. Why would you want him as king? But even more, in addition, he includes Zebul. So all we know about Zebul is what we have here. He taunts Zebul, who is Abimelech's officer. You see, it turns out that Abimelech doesn't even live in what is supposed to be his capital city. He doesn't live in Shechem, apparently because it's too dangerous. And so he has Zebul ruling over the city in his place. He doesn't even trust his own subjects to live among them. So he has a representative who governs in his place. Now, it's interesting. Remember Abimelech's name. Abimelech means my father is king. The one who is drunkenly boasting against him is Gaal, the son of Ebed, or Gaal, the son of a servant. The author is trying to show us the animosity between these two. There's no doubt there is jealousy and envy and utter dislike between these men. They probably have known each other for a very long time, and they don't like each other. Now, unfortunately for Gaal, Zebul hears about this boasting. We don't know where he stands, though. He is Abimelech's officer, but we don't know where his loyalty is. The text isn't clear if he's truly for Abimelech or for himself. He seems to be a master politician playing both sides. Now in verse 30, it says, when he heard of the taunts of Gaal, his anger was kindled. Is he mad because he's taunting Abimelech? Or is he mad because he included Zebul in the taunt? Well, Zebul does send messengers to Abimelech secretly to inform him of this growing rebellion. And he gives Abimelech the makings of a battle plan. Now, it might suggest that Abimelech is not a great military leader. Given the soldiers he chose to hire, this is almost certainly the case. These aren't the kind of men that you'd normally want to go to battle with. The plan seems to be a good plan. There's going to be an ambush in the morning when they're least expecting it. They're going to think it's like any other day. But he knows that Gaal and his men, when they see that there's a battle at hand, they're going to rush out of the city, outside the city gates where their protection is, and they're going to fight him. But Zebul doesn't give Abimelech any strategy whatsoever after this. He simply says, yeah, when they come out, yeah, figure it out. There you go. There's my plan. Just do that, and everything will be good. But will he figure it out? Will he and his worthless rabble figure it out, or will Gaal and his men already have it figured out? Well, again, we're left wondering which side Zebul is on. So Abimelech takes his advice, and he sets an ambush against the city. His city, right? These are the people who made him king. This is where he's king. He sets an ambush against his capital city. This is the chaos of sin. Now, as we saw last week, Shechem is in the valley of Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. The city is on the east side of it, so when the sun comes up, it rises up over the city, and you'll see the sunlight hit the tops of the mountains and then work its way down, just because, you know, the earth isn't flat, it's kind of curved. So that's why. So as the shadows begin to move about in the morning, the light can play tricks on your eyes. So Gaal gets up, he's looking out of the city gate, and he seems to see these shadows moving down the mountains. So he tells Zebul, who's, remember, he's the officer in charge, he's like the city manager or the mayor or maybe the captain of the guard, something like that. And he says, hey, I think I see men coming down from the mountaintops. Zebul delays. He trolls him. He's like, nah, those are just shadows. You're being paranoid. Those aren't men. Sometime later, Gaal is now convinced, no, actually they are men. In fact, they're no longer coming down the mountain. Now they're coming straight, they're at the bottom of the mountain in the valley, coming straight toward us. And further, there's another group coming from another direction. Look, I'm not the most educated person out there, but I know shadows go in the same direction, right? If they're from the same light source, they move in the same direction. Then Zebul springs his trap. Remember, he's angry because of Gaal's drunken boast. He asks him in verse 33, where is your mouth now? See, the ancient Near East was an honor-shame culture. This was actually, by calling him out, this is actually a worse confrontation for Gaal than a physical confrontation would be. It would have been better for him to want to throw hands with him than for him to call him out this way, because by calling out his boast, he has no choice but to leave the city and engage Abimelech in battle. So he takes the men of Shechem, and he met Abimelech outside the city walls, and we read verse 40 again. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him. And many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. And Abimelech lived at Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not dwell at Shechem. Now, why does Gaal and his men flee up to the entrance of the gate. The whole point of a gate, the whole point of city walls, is that you're safer inside than you are outside. Why don't they retreat into the city for protection, protected by its walls and its gates? Well, Zebul is in charge of the city and its protection. It was his city to protect, and he prevented or protected his city by not letting Gaal and his men back in. Now, again, notice the author says Abimelech lived at Arumah, and it was Zebul who drove Gaal and his relatives out of the city. I mean, think of that. Abimelech, who is king of Shechem, does not even enter his capital city in triumph. His city belongs to Zebul. It turns out Zebul is on Zebul's side. Well, the next day, the day after this battle, the battle in which Abimelech was both victorious and defeated, because he couldn't even enter his capital city, he once again lay in wait, ready to ambush his people. So in verse 43, he divided his men into three companies. That ought to sound familiar to those of us who've been through this book. Remember, he's just like his father. Remember, his father had a small army, and what did? They divided in themselves into three companies. Only his father's army was given the task of calling everyone to worship with the trumpets and the torches, not to fight. But remember also, he has his father's sense of vengeance, right? He wants revenge. So in the morning, the citizens of Shechem leave the protection of the city, city walls and the city gate. I mean, think of it. They got work to do, right? It's just another day. But yeah, there had been a battle the day before, but crops still need to be planted. Sheep still need to be sheared. Cows still need to be milked. Fields still need to be plowed. Whatever it is that they have to leave the city to do, they get up like it's any other day, and they leave the city walls so they can go to work. When the gate was opened, the people came out. That's when Abimelech attacked. He sent one of his companies to the city gate to secure it so that they couldn't close it again. And then the other two companies attacked the farmers and shepherds and craftsmen and laborers and killed them. Then verse 45 tells us he fought against the city all day, finally capturing it. Think of that. He captured his capital city and destroyed it. The author says he killed everyone who was in the city, and he razed the city. It means he just tore it down and sowed it with salt. Now, sowing a field with salt would render it useless for growing crops. It would take a lot of salt, but that happened in that day. You can't water crops with salt water, right? If you could, that would solve any freshwater problems we might have. You just can't use salt water to grow corn. It kills the corn. If you put salt in the soil, even fresh rain coming down dissolves the salt, and it's as if you were pouring salt water on your crop. Now, it says he sowed the city with salt. That's probably metaphorical, referring to it's a way to reinforce the idea. He destroyed the city, making it utterly uninhabitable. It was a waste of a city. It was incapable of supporting life. You know, the level of destruction here, it's baffling. Once we see Abimelech is like his father. He is filled with vengeance. He's filled with a desire to prove he is somebody. But he's not done. After destroying the city of Shechem, he sets his sights on the tower of Shechem. This is likely a nearby fortress that would have protected the way to it, similar to Jericho. Jericho, few people would have lived in the fortress. Some did. But fortresses were a place where you would retreat during a battle. If you're being attacked, you would retreat into the fortress. They would store food and water and things necessary to survive a siege. So the leaders of this tower of Shechem, they see hear about the destruction of Shechem. They gather the people into the fortress for protection. Abimelech learns they're hiding in this fortress, and he is still filled with anger and rage. So he takes his worthless and reckless army, and he begins cutting wood. He told them to cut wood as well. Remember what Jotham's prophecy was. Let fire come out of Abimelech, the bramble, and let fire come out of the men of Shechem and devour Abimelech. So they stacked up all this wood on the outside of the tower, and they set fire to it, killing 1,000 men and women, which almost certainly means children as well. Remember, Abimelech is the son of Gideon's concubine, a woman Gideon refused to marry. I mean, he already had several wives, the text tells us. She was just extra. There's no doubt Abimelech was treated the same way as well. He was just extra. I mean, besides, Gideon had 70 sons, plus more than that in daughters to spend his love and affection on, you know, as fathers do. Abimelech's been seething with anger, seething with rage his entire life. His lust for vengeance has boiled over. It began with systematically and brutally executing his brothers one by one. It continues with this horrific attack on these men and women in the tower. Now, most of them likely would have died from smoke. Perhaps the fire would have gotten them. But the evil in this attack is extraordinary. And yet, his anger and his rage still is not satisfied. Abimelech takes his worthless and reckless army to Thebes. Thebes is another fortress nearby. It's a sort of like a suburb of Shechem. Now remember, it has a fortress, and fortresses are defensive. You'd retreat into a fortress when you're attacked. But verse 51 doesn't say that Thebes merely had a tower. It had a great tower. This is a beefy fortress. This is a place of great protection for the people inside. All the men and women and all the leaders of the city fled to the tower when they saw Abimelech's army marching toward them. And once again, Abimelech approaches the tower to burn it with fire. He didn't count on verse 53. Apparently, he hadn't read it. And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Now, what's an upper millstone? It's a household appliance. This ought to sound familiar. This is likely a small millstone, the fact that a woman could pick it up and chuck it. It was used for daily food preparation. Now, in the tower, they would have stored grain, various grains, wheat, etc. But rather than mill up a bunch of wheat into flour and store flour, you just keep the whole kernels there because whole kernels of wheat would have a longer shelf life than milled flour. Since they couldn't predict when an attack would come or how long it would last, you would have also, in addition to these stores of food, you would have the equipment necessary to make food out of it. Weapons, of course, would also be stored in the tower. Now, a milling appliance consisted of two parts. Here's a picture of one from around that day. There's the upper millstone is the one that's on the inside with a handle, and then you have the lower millstone. Now, the upper millstone has a hole in the middle. You'd pour grain or wheat kernels of wheat, whatever, in there. On the bottom of it are some grooves cut in a specific direction. And this was women's work, by the way. Women would pour grain into that center hole and just begin turning this mill. Eventually, it would pull all the grain down and grind it into flour. You'd lift out the upper millstone, you'd dump out the lower millstone, and now you have a bowl of flour to make whatever you're going to make with it. Now, the upper millstone would weigh between 5 and 10 pounds. About the weight of a bag of flour at Meijer. Think of who throws it. This certain woman, I love that we don't have her name. Like, how humiliating for him. This certain woman cannot meet him in armed combat, right? Men as a whole are bigger, stronger, faster than women. We're bigger. Men are also more likely to have been trained in hand-to-hand combat than a woman would be. She can't fight him one-on-one. So she does what she can. Just like Jael did with Sisera, with her household appliance. She drops the millstone onto Abimelech's head. Now the result of 5 to 10 pounds of stone hitting your head from such a high height is as expected, but it's also a bit unexpected, right? Verse 53, it says it crushes his skull. That's not a surprise. And yet he remains conscious. Like, how is that possible? Well, surely this is part of the judgment on his brutality. He remains aware of his end all the way to the end. And he knows it was a woman who threw the millstone. Now, it's likely that as he lay there bleeding at the base of this tower, this woman, this certain woman, is on top of the tower, jeering and taunting him, along with all the other men and women on top of the tower. Look what just happened to you. You came here to hurt us. Look what happened to you. I threw my KitchenAid at you. Again, being in an honor-shame culture and having had his skull crushed by a woman's kitchen appliance, Abimelech instructs his armor-bearer to take his life. You pull out your sword and you kill me so that in the future no one's going to say, a woman killed Abimelech. You know, centuries later, when David was king, his close friend Uriah the Hittite was killed in battle. You probably know the story. His military commander, Joab, gave instructions to a messenger to go tell David about Uriah's death. As part of the message, the messenger was to ask David a particular question. Look what he asks him. This is in 2 Samuel 11. Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Well, so much for not letting people know how he actually died. It's interesting, Joab changes the name Jerubbaal to Jerubbaal, from let Baal fight him to let shame fight him. The last thing Abimelech wanted was more shame, so he had his armor bearer thrust him through with a sword. I love Old Testament scholar Daniel Stulak. He noted, thus, my father is king, that's Abimelech, will be remembered forever as having died in exactly the manner he wished to avoid, simultaneously emasculated like Sisera and slashed through his belly like Eglon. It's interesting. As soon as Abimelech's men see that he's dead, the text says everyone just went home. There's no sense of vengeance, no hint of loyalty, no desire to get him back for killing their king. They just went home as if it were, I don't know, Tuesday. This is what sin does. Sin promises you the world, but it leaves you broken and bleeding and alone. One of the significant questions we ask in this world today, we ask it in general and of this text in particular, is why? Why does it take God so long to bring an end to evil? I mean, this false king is raised up by his own people as an oppressor of his people, and God does not stop him or them from their reign of terror for 3 long years. Again, think of the lived experience of the people at the time. They experience violence because of the hostility between Abimelech, who doesn't even really function as a king, and the leaders who made him king. The workers in the city weren't part of that. Those who plowed fields and tended vineyards and sheared sheep weren't part of that, yet they all suffered because of that. Why does God show so much patience with Abimelech's evil? Why? Let me reframe that question in a way that's going to make each one of us really uncomfortable. Why does God show so much patience with your sin? Why does God show so much patience with my sin? You see, it's much easier to ask about God's patience with the sin of others, but that same patience God displayed with Abimelech's sin is the patience I've experienced. Look, I've never murdered a single person. Wanted to, but I've never actually murdered anyone, let alone 70 people. But the same patience that is on display in Abimelech's life is the patience I experience when I grumble. Here's the reality. God patiently waited because he was giving Abimelech time to repent and believe. Look, Abimelech at any time could have turned from his sin and worshiped the God of Israel. He could have turned from his sin, and through the sacrificial system God himself gave to Israel, he could have atoned for his sins, though they were many. Look, I cannot know all the reasons God delayed judgment and allowed his evil to run amok, but I know of at least one reason: his mercy. Again and again, Abimelech was given opportunity to turn from his evil, and again, he chose his evil. But God will not be mocked. His holiness and his justice are undefeated. Verses 56 and 57 make it clear that God returned the evil of Abimelech back upon him, and he made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads. Remember, this ain't karma. This is justice. This is God's faithfulness to his covenant. This is God keeping his word, because God remains true to his word even when no one else will. See, God knows sin is a dangerous thing. It only brings suffering. It only brings pain. It only brings destruction. It cannot give you life, though it promises to give you life. Sin promises to give you everything you ever desired, and it's always a lie. You might be able to shield yourself from the effects of sin for a time, but the truth is you cannot stop a certain woman from showing up with a kitchen appliance. You never know when it's coming. In fact, sin will always be revealed for what it is, and it is never pretty. Look, I don't know if there's anyone here who's ever murdered someone. I don't know if I want to know. I am quite confident, however, that the warning of Jesus that being filled with anger and rage is the same as murder means there are those here who are, in fact, guilty of murder. I'm quite confident that there are those here who are guilty of adultery, because in the words of Jesus, to look upon someone with lust in your heart is to commit adultery. He also spoke against those whose yes and no cannot be trusted. They cannot be relied upon. He spoke of those whose desire for vengeance and retribution, right? You know, those who demanded an eye for an eye. Whatever the manifestation of your particular sin is in your life, the truth is the Lord is calling each one of us here today to kill it, to lay it on the altar, to allow it to remain on the altar before the Lord. You see, woven throughout this sordid story of great evil is the shadow of the king, right? Now, in Abimelech's day, the king who was coming was still a long ways off. The people there thought he would never come. But when he came, he didn't come like anyone expected, because he didn't come wielding a sword ready to destroy God's enemies. He didn't come for that kind of battle at all. Now, he came for God's enemies. Let's be clear. Jesus came for God's enemies, but not to pour out vengeance on them. He came for God's enemies that he might rescue God's enemies. But think of how he came to rescue. He became Abimelech. He became Gideon. He became you. He became me. In fact, here's how Paul put it. He said, for our sake, he made him, Jesus, to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in Jesus, we might become the righteousness of God. See, God became one of us that he might take our sin upon himself and might offer himself as the sacrifice that takes away our sin. And the outcome of all this work is that we would become the righteousness of God. He takes our sin upon himself and he lays his righteousness on top of us so that we're covered in it through and through. See, this story shows us there is only one who can make us holy. There is only one who can save. Now, in the midst of this dark, I've struggled all week with it, this dark and dreadful story that so many really do find depressing, I get it, is the very solution to the struggle we all have. Because the story of Abimelech shows us we cannot save ourselves. It shows us what our sin, that's your sin, my sin, his sin, her sin, their sin. It shows us what our sin would look like if it were allowed to run freely, unchecked, uncontrolled by God. God has chosen to intervene by granting us mercy and grace that he might transform us. Church, we've seen over these last few months that God has called us to be as a body to reclaim the land, so to speak, to drive idolatry out of our midst. So we must do what Israel was called to do. We must drive idolatry. We must drive sin out of our midst. It's not just that we're surrounded in this den of iniquity with, you know, we got a porn shop, we got a liquor store. Like, it's not just that we're surrounded by evil. It's that we have sin in our midst. We all struggle with this. So we must invest ourselves in seeing this world from God's perspective and make and embracing his perspective on the sin that we all struggle with. We have to learn to see it from God's perspective. That means we must learn to love what God loves. We must learn to hate what God hates. We must allow his spirit to change us from the inside out, driving out darkness and despair by filling us with hope and with faith. Abimelech illustrates the truth for us. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. We must treasure the Lord Jesus. We must treasure his gospel, because if we will do that, if we will truly seek to see things from his perspective and to saturate ourselves with his love, with his truth, with his gospel, we will soon discover that our hearts are being changed. Where our treasure is, there our hearts will be. Let's treasure Jesus.